This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's May, it's warm, and many Granite Staters look forward to getting outside this time of year. But whether that means a little yard work or an all-day hike, you might want to also include tick prevention in those outdoor plans. That's because New Hampshire has among the nation's highest rates of the tick-borne illness Lyme disease. It's a far cry from just 2 decades ago when you barely heard about Lyme disease here. Still, there may be a little hope this year with the dry winter possibly causing trouble for black-legged ticks, which carry the virus. Also, if information is power, we have a lot of it these days. How to prevent tick bites, how to spot a problem tick, and how better landscape management can reduce tick populations. Today in The Exchange, we're talking ticks again, what you need to know as another warm weather outdoor season begins. So let's hear from you this hour. Your questions, comments, concerns about ticks and Lyme disease are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have 3 guests for the hour. Dr. Benjamin Chan is here, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. He's also an infectious disease physician. Dr. Chan, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Abigail Mathewson, surveillance epidemiologist program manager and state public health veterinarian at the Department of Health and Human Services as well. And Abby, nice to see you again, too. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also with us, Alan Eaton, UNH Cooperative Extension entomologist and integrated pest management specialist. Alan has been studying ticks and Lyme disease in New Hampshire for 3 decades. And Alan, it's always good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Alan, I do want to start with you. Every year we talk about this, and every year the forecast is a little different depending on the winter that we've just been through. So how did this year's relatively warm and dry winter affect tick populations here in New Hampshire?
Many of us would like to hear that it knocked them back a bit, but actually the evidence suggests that they kind of survived the winter pretty well. In order for us to have a high mortality, we would need to have really cold conditions in combination with bare ground, and we didn't have that too much. So I'm sorry to report that they probably survived relatively well. Now, having said that, last year we had an extended drought over much of the state. And so the adults of black-legged tick that would have appeared in the fall and this spring got knocked back because the nymphs survived poorly in that drought. So we had relatively low numbers of adults this fall and this spring. But now we're starting in with the nymphs, and I'm not sure how they've done. So we'll just have to see.
And where are we right now in terms of the tick life cycle?
If we're talking about black-legged tick,
the ones we need to worry about,
that spreads Lyme disease, the very end of the adult activity is about now. I spotted an adult and photographed one 8 or 9 days ago, and the nymphs are starting their activity right now. I had one brought in that was collected only, let's see, on the 12th. So the nymph activity is picking up. And the nymphs are the ones that most frequently spread this. They're much smaller than the adults. They're harder for us to see. They're harder for us to feel when they walk on us. So as a result, we're in the period now when the risk is highest of acquiring these things. And it'll stay high through all of June and a fair amount into July, depending on how much rain we get.
And again, dry weather, you know, farmers may not like it, but it's good for reducing tick populations. Is that right, Alan?
That's right. They ticks respond very quickly, especially a small species like black-legged tick. It dries out quickly, and if we don't have regular rain and regular chances to pick up moisture, then they stop questing, which is searching for a host, and drop back into the leaf litter to rehydrate. So, yes.
Well, and Alan, just remind us again, we keep talking about black-legged ticks. Are those the only ticks we need to worry about?
That's the tick that probably spreads well over 90% of the tick-borne diseases in our state. But there's a couple of other species that once in a while can spread one of these. And if you and I have – if we have listeners way down south, well, then there's other species like that can spread things like Rocky Mountain spotted fever and so forth, which is kind of rare up here. So it's the one we need to focus on, but it's not the only one.
Well, we've got lots of pictures and information on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Maps, photographs, kind of some icky ones that Alan Eaton has shared with us.
Oh, this is nice. You don't like this picture?
Remind us, Alan, just real quickly, how small these nymphs are. That's the problem, isn't it? You really can't see these things.
It can be. And, of course, the nymphs, a black-legged tick, are approximately a millimeter in size, 25 millimeters to the inch, thereabouts. So I like food references. They're about the size of a poppy seed. And if you've been checking yourself for ticks regularly in the spring like I have, then you've been practicing on the adults, which are bigger, 2 or 3 millimeters in the case of black-legged tick. So that makes a nymph a little more challenging to spot, but not impossible. If you had really dark skin or if you have lots and lots of freckles, that makes it a little harder to find. But a millimeter, that's the size.
Well, and Dr. Chan, as Alan is describing, every year it's a little different. But what's the message from the state on ticks and Lyme disease prevention this year?
Yeah, as Alan mentioned, you know, ticks can be very small, and there are a variety of different species of ticks. The black-legged ticks, which are the ones we are mainly concerned about here in New Hampshire for not only spreading infections like Lyme disease, but also Babesia, Anaplasma, there's a whole host of different infections that can be spread through the black-legged tick. These ticks tend to be smaller than some of the other ticks like dog ticks that people can find. So it's very important to take some steps when you're outside to try and prevent tick bites. You know, that can include wearing, you know, FDA-approved tick insect repellent, doing tick checks when you come inside, taking your clothes and throwing them in the wash and the dryer to kill the ticks. As Alan mentioned, they're very susceptible to drying out. And so if you hit them with, you know, heat and drying, they tend to not survive very well. And, you know, it's not a popular message because we like to be outside in the sun and the warmth. But, you know, wearing long pants and long clothing is generally recommended, although, you know, I understandably people may want to be outside in shorts and T-shirt. It's, you know, it's important to just, you know, take the necessary precautions, both when you're outside, but also after you come inside to do the tick checks.
Well, and you mentioned a couple other diseases besides Lyme disease that are transmitted by these black-legged ticks. Can you mention those again, Dr. Chan, please? Because those are less familiar to folks.
Yes, and they're also less commonly identified. So the other ones we tend to see in New Hampshire are infections called Anaplasma or Anaplasmosis and Babesia. These occur in much less occur much less commonly than Lyme disease. I think in the last few years we've had on the order of like 1,500 to 1,600 cases of Lyme disease reported to the public health department. You know, cases of Anaplasma and Babesia are much less than that.
What are the symptoms of those two illnesses?
They tend to be pretty similar, very nonspecific, vague symptoms, which is part of the problem with, you know, some of these tick-borne diseases. People will oftentimes start off with a fever, muscle aches, muscle pains, headaches.
So it could be anything,
It could be anything. And, you know, some people get infected with Anaplasma, for example, and don't have any symptoms, and it's not a problem. They clear the infection on their own. So it's something for people to be aware of, that there are a number of different infections you can get from tick bites. And, you know, ideally we would prevent the bite and the infection in the first place.
Well, and Abby, I want to get to you too, but one more question on these different diseases, Lyme and Anaplasma, and the others you mentioned, Dr. Chan. So let's say, you know, one of my kids says, Mom, I feel crummy, you know, and he's got a little fever, he's got a little headache. I mean, at what point do I take him into the doctor and get him tested for Lyme or one of these other illnesses? And how good are those tests, by the way?
There's a couple questions there. You know, I think that if parents have concerns about their kids' health, they should obviously call their healthcare provider and get them checked out. You know, certainly with Lyme disease, one of the very early symptoms of Lyme disease is what we call an erythema migrans type rash. We sometimes call it a bullseye rash, which is an expanding, you know, erythematous or red ring-like rash that people get 70 to 80% of the time after a tick bite, that's an early indication of Lyme disease. And so if parents see that, they should certainly call the healthcare provider because there are good antibiotics to treat Lyme disease. But I think in general, you know, if a person or a kid are is not feeling well and they're not getting better, you know, I think that's a key feature. If they're not getting better, they should call their healthcare provider.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us this hour as we talk about Lyme disease and ticks this year in the Granite State, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Well, all of you, since we're talking about children, we're joined now by Aubrey Nelson. She's president of New Hampshire Environmental Educators, and she's a science teacher and outdoor program coordinator at the Beech Hill School. And Aubrey, great to have you. Welcome to the exchange.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, so what works, Aubrey, in terms of teaching kids how to be aware of ticks but not terrified of ticks?
So I guess I would say that the first thing that I try to do is just model a calm demeanor. I think that as an adult, especially, if you can educate yourself about ticks and realize, okay, we have about 24 hours before a tick is going to bite you. Ticks don't just, like, take a nibble here and then a nibble there. They, like, really latch on, so you can know if you've gotten a bite, if they're attached to you, as opposed to, there's one crawling on me, did it bite me? And just keeping a calm demeanor so that the kids can see that, you know, it's okay. And that helps tremendously. And from there, I try to educate the students, too. And if I can pique their curiosity instead of just their kind of horror. so we try to say, okay, well, can we identify this tick? I tell them if it has a brown butt, then it's a deer tick or a black-legged tick. There's different names for them. But and if it's a dog tick, it has kind of a white collar on its back, so dogs have collars. We try to tell, is it male or female? Usually we see the female ticks because they tend to want your blood meal. But, you know, we talk about everywhere a deer can go, our habitats that ticks will tend to be. And we talk about where to check for ticks. I kind of tell them, you know, we can all giggle, but they like warm places because, so check your warm places because that's where they're sure that blood is close to the surface. So, you know, and then finally I tell them about Lyme, but I try not to focus too much on symptoms or things that might be overwhelming for kids. Instead, just look out for targets, look for things, even if they just look like a freckle, but talk to them almost like they're adults. I think treating them like, ooh, this is creepy, we don't want to talk about this with you, you know, puts them off.
Well, and you're sort of touching on this, Aubrey, but I'll ask you anyway. So what doesn't work with kids? What's the wrong way to go when it comes to teaching them about, you know, the possible threats of Lyme disease from ticks?
Okay, so, yeah.
Don't flip out, in other words.
Yeah, don't flip out. Don't flip out. There's nothing harder than trying to get a tick off a kid who's, like, squirming and, you know, I think that modeling that demeanor, I've had more than one tick get, like, flung across the room if they're like, So that helps. But also, I think that, like I said, focusing on, like, scary stories of Lyme or, you know, things like that that are going to make kids scared to go outside is really the wrong approach because we want our kids outside.
Well, and to that end, Aubrey, how concerned are you that parents or kids themselves might go overboard with these tick fears and use this as a reason not to get out?
I'm actually very concerned about that. So as an environmental educator, I just can't help but think about all the studies that continue to show how important outdoor play is for healthy mental and physical development. And hands down, keeping your kids outside in the long run, even if they were to get Lyme, in my opinion, Lyme is scary, but it's even scarier to me to not have kids outside. So it's a problem. And I've heard some parents tell me, especially for younger kids, that they're worried to have their child outside playing, partially because kids aren't as observant, but I think that is kind of where the education needs to be, is to teach your kids to be observant, to integrate maybe tick checks into hygiene routines. So, you know, as a lot of kids will have charts like, did you brush your teeth? Did you, you know, put on your socks? Did you check for ticks? I think integrating that into hygiene routines or making a game out of it, that it's something that you can do in your family. Like, I'll say, like, TikTok, time for a tick check, you know, and something like that that can be part of your routine, because ticks aren't going away. So, I don't know, to think that an answer is not to bring kids outside is pretty scary.
So the physical and mental health benefits, in your opinion, Aubrey, far, far, far outweigh the possibility of ticks and Lyme disease.
Yeah, definitely.
What kinds of tick prevention efforts do you do for yourself, Aubrey, and your students when you take them out?
That's a good question. So mostly vigilance and tick checks. I have kind of mixed feelings about DEET, for instance, which I understand, you know, if you're past the age of procreation, use DEET all you want. But with young kids, it scares me a little, especially if you've got young kids who are then, like, spraying it and then putting their hands in their mouth. It seems kind of like a, you know, there's a cost benefit to that. So we try to use more natural, some of the more natural natural type things instead of DEET. Repellents. But the pants and the socks, I think is fine. But once you get to middle school, that's like way too much of a fashion police problem.
I understand you there. Yes.
Yeah. So light colored clothes, I think, are underrated. So if you've got, you know, white pants or even white shorts, I know that shorts aren't as good, but again, the fashion police might interfere. So I think that if you've got, you know, lighter colored socks, light colored things, I encourage kids to wear that. Even though it gets dirtier, you can see things much more easily. And just the education is protection in itself. I think as soon as kids realize, you know, whenever we're going to a grassy area, hey, we're at a high risk here. We have a lot of tall grass, and it's very moist, and so ticks are really happy. But, you know, every day I try to remind them and they remind each other. And I think that's sometimes the best prevention is the education.
Well, what's the one message that you really want to get out there, Aubrey, about good, solid education, either by teachers or schools or parents on this topic?
I guess as the climate changes and we're going to see more and more of these, that integrating it both into curriculum, but also into that hygiene routine of this is going to be a normal thing and we need to deal with it and we shouldn't sacrifice going outside. So don't freak out. Don't not go outside, but make it part of your hygiene routine, just like brushing your teeth.
Well, Aubrey, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Aubrey Nelson, president of New Hampshire Environmental Educators, a science teacher and outdoor program coordinator at the Beech Hill School. Alan Eaton, do you want to add into anything that Aubrey said there? Lots of good points.
I liked what Aubrey said. And when my students, of course, I deal with college students and the public. And the one thing that I say is pretty much what Aubrey said. And that is the top 10 things, the top three of them are daily tick checks during tick season. It's free. Doesn't cost you any money, and it protects yourself. I'm convinced that people can dramatically reduce their risk or dramatically increase their risk, depending on what they do. And that's the one thing that I hit on again and again.
Well, and Dr. Chan, you know, as a doctor, what do you think about Aubrey's point that, yes, Lyme disease is a problem, but bigger problems might be childhood obesity and the physical and mental health benefits that you get from being outside?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, there's a whole host of different dangers out there, and I think it's important to keep the focus on maintaining a healthy lifestyle. I think she's absolutely right that it's important to make this routine, not to scare children, not to scare families. And to try and find the tick early. And so even if somebody may not want to use DEET or another insect repellent, you know, there are other ways to prevent tick bites by doing tick checks.
All right, and we'll talk more after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're getting the lowdown on ticks and Lyme disease With spring comes an unwelcome harbinger of the season, black-legged ticks. And as we're hearing, New Hampshire is near the top of the list of states with the highest incidence of Lyme disease. So Granite Staters tend to take this little bug, or arachnid, I should say, Alan Eaton, very seriously. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Alan Eaton is here. He's with UNH Cooperative Extension. He's an entomologist and integrated pest management specialist. He's been studying ticks and Lyme in New Hampshire for a long time. Also with us, Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. He's an infectious disease physician. And also with us, Abigail Mathewson. She's a surveillance epidemiology program manager and state public health veterinarian here in the Granite State. And Abby, I did want to start with you. We often hear, as I just said, that New Hampshire has one of the highest rates of Lyme disease in the country. Why is that? Why New Hampshire?
Well, we have done some studies looking at the tick population in New Hampshire. Many thanks to Dr. Alan Eaton for supplying us with ticks for that, and some of the other contracted workers that helped us collect ticks in years gone by. When we look at those in the lab, we find that approximately 60% of the ticks in New Hampshire are carriers for Lyme disease. And so that really feeds into the high incidence rate that we see in New Hampshire. Why those ticks have such a high prevalence, we can make some theories and guesses as to why that's happening. And we know over the last decades, 100 years or a little bit longer, the landscape in New Hampshire has dramatically changed and the host populations for the ticks have dramatically changed. And so what that means is many, many years ago, the 100 or so years ago, we had near clear cutting of New Hampshire. There were a lot of farms, you know, small operations, lots of cleared pastures, pretty extensive hunting of the white-tailed deer. So we didn't have much of a deer population. We didn't have much of a forest habitat for them. Things have changed.
So deer are still the major carriers, though I hear about mice too, right, Abby?
Deer are the major reproductive host for the black-legged tick, which is very different than the reservoir host. And so...
So you'll have to explain that in a minute, but go ahead.
I certainly will. So what you need are those three things, though. And so we've had this change in the landscape. So we've had a greening of our landscape, which is great. And we've had the comeback of the white-tailed deer, which is great because we have a really strong hunter population. They're a very charismatic animal. They're important for the ecosystem. But we also have this rodent problem. But we have rodents in New Hampshire as we do across the country. And so we have the three things to set up the cycle of Lyme disease. We have a really good habitat, and we have a healthy population of reproductive hosts, and we have a very healthy population of reservoir hosts. And we've also fragmented our habitat. So that means we have a lot of edge habitat because we like to go out and live in the woods. It's very beautiful, and it's fun. And, you were just mentioning the risks of obesity and not getting outside. And so we've kind of, as the human population has, I think, absorbed some of that. And there's a drive, especially in New Hampshire, to get out and enjoy the
woods. Sure, it's beautiful. So fragmented means basically what used to be one big giant forest is now a little forest here and then a town and then a neighborhood and then a little more forest here. And it's broken up.
Right.
Why is that conducive to ticks and the animals that carry ticks? Like deer and mice?
Well, it creates less biodiversity, but more importantly, you have a lot of that edge habitat that the deer like to come and browse on because it's fresh
and
it's growing. Because you're continually trying to keep the woods from consuming your yards. But then you also have bird feeders out and you have garbage out and things like that that are attractive to rodents. And not every rodent is, or bird. There are some birds that are capable of being reservoirs, which means they are the source of the actual pathogen or the bacterium for Lyme disease. You have them out there being a food source for the ticks. And Alan can speak more to the life cycle, but when you have the deer coming in with the adult ticks that are feeding on them, they're not serving as a source. The deer themselves are not serving as a source of the pathogen, but they're serving as a mechanism to get the tick into those areas where they can then pick up the infection by the mice.
I see. So go ahead. Yeah.
Well, and so part of the problem is, you know, you see some of these, you could basically call them urban deer almost, where you can have deer come into your yards and you can't necessarily go out and hunt them because you're in a community that you can't do anything about the deer coming into your yard, dropping off the ticks that are then laying the eggs to have the larva hatch. And then you have this cycle where they feed on the rodents and then they get infected. And it's a very, very complex cycle that we've set up.
Alan, I'd love your thoughts on this, too.
I like what Abby said, and I would add one more thing to it. I think the thing that Abby didn't mention is that we also have a lot of potential victims in our state who haven't gotten the message to check themselves daily, who haven't got the message to use gaiters or tuck pants in, and as a result, we get this. I think that's an additional factor. When I go south of here in New England and look at the game reserves or places like that, I find people tucking their pant legs in, putting repellents on and so forth. That's much less common when I visit them in New Hampshire. I think that's a factor.
Really? So
yes.
It isn't just these landscape factors and wildlife factors that Abby mentioned. It's also just we here in New Hampshire aren't as savvy?
I think we haven't gotten it. Not enough of us have gotten the message and taken to heart and changed our behaviors. I can't prove it, but I suspect that's the case from what I see. And that's from me going to various places here in New Hampshire, also southeastern Massachusetts and Connecticut and Rhode Island.
Wow.
That I see differences.
Abby and then Dr. Chan, you want to jump in on that? And then we'll go to our callers.
I would just like to say I completely agree with Dr. Eaton just said about that. And we do have some education initiatives outlined in our prevention plan that we have online. And we are actively seeking people to help us get the message out. We're focusing initially on children, trying to target children.
Without scaring them, as Aubrey mentioned.
Right, without scaring them, because we want to make it very clear that it is important for kids to be getting outside and enjoying the natural beauty that New Hampshire just abounds with. And so we are actively seeking out partners for that and piloting sites and the like, and anybody can contact us to try and get in on that.
Dr. Chan, what do you think about what Alan said?
Yeah, I think both what Abby and Alan have said are good points. You know, we are increasingly putting ourselves, humans, our families, our kids, into contact with sort of the environments where we can be exposed to ticks.
Because of the way we've broken up the landscape,
exactly,
and so forth.
Yes, yes. But with that said, you know, we need to be outside and enjoying our state and the places we live in and being active. But that involves trying to educate people about the correct steps for prevention. And unfortunately, behavior change is a very difficult thing to change. You know, behavior is difficult to change. And that's why we keep saying the same messages over and over again, because it helps to reinforce that.
Yeah, and I keep saying over and over again to you, Dr. Chan, I'm not going to wear long pants tucked into my socks in the summertime when it's beautiful out. You know, you spend so much time being bundled up in New Hampshire. It's nice to not have to do that.
Yeah, and that's okay. You know, that is a recommended approach to prevent tick bites. But as I mentioned, there are many other ways to make sure you don't get bitten by a tick, or to find the tick early, even if it has bitten you. So again, there's multiple different options and ways to combine prevention techniques to prevent tick bites and to prevent transmission of Lyme disease.
Let's take some calls, all of you. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're taking your questions, comments, concerns about Lyme disease here in New Hampshire and the tick populations, 1-800-892-6477. And in Wentworth, Paula is on the line. Hi, Paula. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two brief questions. One is it true that a tick needs to be attached for 24 hours to transmit the disease? And my second question is, there's a vaccine for dogs but not for people. And does that mean that the vaccine for dogs is not effective? I just wanted to comment on why there would be a vaccine for dogs and not people. And
two great questions, Paula. Thank you so much. And Alan, to you first on the first question, how long does a tick need to be attached before it can transmit the disease? Do we know?
It's my under, and again, I assume we're talking about Lyme disease here. Mm-hmm. The answer is different for some of the other pathogens.
I see.
If we're talking about Lyme disease, the evidence from the labs that have done the work suggests that if for a nymph, 24 hours of biting time, approximately, for an adult tick, again, black-legged, something on the order of 30 hours, maybe even slightly more. So, yes, that seems to be the case, and different studies in different places have come up with those same figures in research.
Well, and the vaccine question, Dr. Chan, I'm so glad Paula asked because it's a question I have as well. Why isn't there a vaccine against Lyme disease?
Yeah, so there actually used to be a vaccine for Lyme disease, and this was a vaccine that had been introduced into the human population in the late 90s, early 2000s, but it was withdrawn from the market around 2002. The manufacturer cites that it was because of low demand, but, you know, it wasn't the most effective vaccine in humans. And people, I believe, also had some complaints about having side effects like joint aches and joint pains from the vaccine. And so there was not a high demand for it. And so for that reason, the human vaccine was withdrawn from the market. There is not a new vaccine that I'm aware of in the immediate future. There is talk of a need for a vaccine, and I've seen some papers that have come out. I think a few years ago there was a paper in the Lancet Infectious Disease Journal that looked at options for vaccines and looked at, you know, tolerability of vaccines and how well they stimulated a person's immune response. But to my knowledge, there has not been a manufacturer that has picked up the production of a new Lyme disease vaccine. Regarding the question about the effectiveness in dogs, I'd have to defer to Abby on that one.
Yeah, actually, our colleague at WBUR, Kurt Nickisch, did a very good piece looking into this question. So, Paul, if you want to know more, we've put that on our website as well, nhpr.org/exchange. And Kurt really looked back at the history of this vaccine, some of the complaints about it, and the frustration that some doctors have today that there is not a vaccine. Kurt also did quote one of these doctors saying that some people do go to their veterinarians in desperation and convince the veterinarian to inject them with a canine vaccine. Now, that's from Kurt's article. You can look at it online. I'm guessing nobody on this panel is going to recommend that you go to your vet and say, give me what you gave Fido.
No one would recommend that at all.
Although people are feeling desperate for this lack of vaccine. I wonder what your thoughts are, Abby, on that.
Well, the vaccine in dogs is very effective, and it works in a very similar manner to how the human vaccine used to work. And it's a very interesting way to administer a vaccine. And so what happens is you get the vaccine, and then you produce antibodies against the pathogen that the tick will then consume, and then those antibodies will kill the pathogen inside the tick instead of waiting for it to get into your body. So it's a very interesting mechanism, but it's been very effective in dogs. I will say no vaccine is 100%, so there is some breakthrough, and it's a vaccine that you have to get every year for your dog. But I think it's a very, very safe, very effective vaccine for your canine companions.
Yeah, and there's also a little liquid we put on the back of our cats' necks once a month. Mm-hmm. Kind of expensive, but seems to work. And sometimes my husband and I say, isn't there something we can put on the back of our necks, you know, to prevent us getting Lyme disease? Did you want to jump in, Dr. Chan?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, the human vaccine used to work in the exact same way. And I think it gets back to Paula's question about how long a tick needs to be attached for. So the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, Borrelia bacteria, is in the gut of a tick. And so when a tick bites you, it doesn't automatically transmit that bacteria right away. It takes some time, and that's where Alan was talking, it taking, you know, 1 to 2 days for that bacteria to migrate from the gut of the tick into the person. And so there's a period of time there that a couple things can happen. One is that you can find the tick and take it off and be at no risk for getting Lyme disease. The other, and this is where the vaccine came in, is that when somebody was immunized with the vaccine, your body would produce antibodies. And then when a tick fed on you, that vaccine response in your blood would then kill the bacteria in the gut of the tick before it could migrate into the person. Now, that vaccine is available for pets and dogs, but not for humans at this time.
All right. Well, let's go to our listeners again. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. A bunch of emails have just come in. And here's one from Tom, in Auburn, who says, I have caught Lyme disease several times. As a preventative measure, I now treat my clothing with permethrin. I hope permethrin. I'm pronouncing that. Okay, yep. Permethrin. Tom says, any comments about this? Alan, do you want to answer Tom's question there?
Permethrin is an insecticide. It is very effective on killing ticks. It's been registered to be applied, certain forms of it, to be applied to clothing. It adheres especially to cotton extremely well and will last through a number of washings. And so you can buy it pre-treated or you can get a pressurized can and spray it. You have to take your pants off first before you spray it. I'm going to get a picture of myself doing that someday, pantless and doing that spray.
And, we won't put that picture on our
website.
Then
you let it dry, and it can it's classified as a repellent, but it's actually beginning to kill the ticks, and in response they drop off. So it can be extremely effective. Permethrin is the active ingredient, and there are a number of treatments that you can purchase under different brands that take advantage of this, and it is a very nice option to have.
So it's not a repellent that you spray on your ankles or your pants.
That's right. You put it on the
clothing
and you let it dry, and then it will, especially on cotton clothing, it works extremely well and stays adhering to it for a very long time. Very effective.
Well, we talked earlier about the importance of getting outside and how much New Hampshire people love to do that. And with us now for more on that is Dave Anderson. He's Director of Education and Volunteer Services at the Forest Society, where he's responsible for conservation education programs. And Dave, welcome back. Good to have you.
Hey, thanks, Laura. Thanks for inviting me on today. It's a great topic, and this is the right time of year to be talking about it.
Right. Well, so how long, Dave, have you been hiking about in the woods of New Hampshire?
Well, since I was a freshman at Plymouth State University in the Outing Club way back when dinosaurs still roamed the earth, about 35 years ago.
Well, and when did you first then, given that long history in New Hampshire's woods, when did you first start thinking about ticks?
Well, that's the thing.
Lyme.
There has been a change. There's been an awareness of what's going on. As more of us know people who have been affected by Lyme disease or the other blood-borne illnesses. And I would say that really even as recently as, 5 or 10 years ago, I would just routinely pick ticks off my clothing and not think too much about it. There's a forester with the Division of Forest and Land, Scott Rolfe, who's been really helpful in giving tick talks. He was actually diagnosed with babesiosis, and his other family members had Lyme. And I've heard his talk twice, and I would recommend that to anybody who has an opportunity to talk to somebody who's been through the medical ordeal of treating these. And that really has increased my awareness and vigilance about taking preventative measures when out in the woods. And I thought it was great that panelists today talked about the importance of not being afraid to go in the woods, but also taking proper precautions.
Well, can you talk a little bit more about that, Dave, please? This specter of Lyme disease and other illnesses, how that affects the psychology that you at the Forest Society promote, which is being excited, get outside, experience New Hampshire's natural beauty.
Right. Well, that's just the thing, is fear sells. And so we used to hear from people about, the fear of poison ivy. And then, of course, are you afraid to go to the beach because of the specter of skin cancer? No, we've all learned about the need to apply sunscreen every single time when we go outside. That doesn't mean we stay indoors. And similarly with the specter of Lyme disease and other blood-borne diseases and even a new tick in New Hampshire, that Lone Star tick, that people will come to me and say, I'm afraid because I just heard this. And so there's that sort of culture of fear. And it's important to say to people, look, it's really easy to take precautions, to be safe out in the woods, to spray, and tuck your pants, and then check yourself every single time. I also think that
And Dave, hold on. I got to jump in on you, but I have another question for you, too. So we'll take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're getting the latest in terms of ticks and prevention of tick-borne illnesses like Lyme disease. Give us a call with your questions, comments, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we've been talking with Dave Anderson, again, Director of Education and Volunteer Services at the Forest Society. And Dave, go ahead. You were talking about your hopes that people would still get out and
right.
Not let the fear of ticks and other tick-borne illnesses like Lyme disease, keep them inside.
Right. That would be a terrible unintended consequence of people having more awareness is just simply staying inside. You know, we very much want people to get outside and enjoy the natural beauty of New Hampshire and just recognize what tick habitats are like, recognize things people can do in terms of precautions and preventative measures, permethrin spray, permethrin in freeze gaiters or clothing, spraying DEET on exposed skin, and then just check yourself and understand that, you know, a shower alone may not be enough. And putting clothing where you've been exposed to ticks in a dryer for 30 minutes on high heat can kill the ticks rather than just throwing them in the hamper and having them crawl around your house. The other thing I want to mention is I think that in gardening and doing yard work and being in the backyard is actually a little bit, I get more ticks doing work in the backyard at home than I do hiking.
Really?
When you're hiking in the middle of a trail, if you're not brushing against the undergrowth on either side of the trail where the ticks are questing, waiting for you to walk by so they can actually brush up against them, if you're walking in the middle of a trail, you're not going to typically pick up as many ticks. It's when you sit down in the grass or you're crawling around on your hands and knees working in a garden. And then also pets, dogs and cats. I had a tick this morning that came in on the dog and was crawling around on the couch. And you know, this is the time of year where we've got to really watch ourselves and check ourselves, but also recognize that our pets run out. They run through the wet grass in the morning and they bring a tick load into the house. And so it's not just the hiking aspect, it's also our pets and while we're working in the gardens. But we have that uncomfortable feeling when there's a tick crawling on us, and I think that's a survival mechanism.
Yeah.
And I joke, you know, my Native American name was Crawling with Ticks. You know, I'd come home with 10 or 12 ticks at the end of the day that had been crawling on me, and now I take that really seriously. And as soon as I feel one, and other people have said this, you know, as soon as somebody picks a tick off, everybody feels them all over them. So checking your hairline, in the back of your neck, and having somebody check your back where you can't see, and do that every single time.
All right. Well, Dave, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you, Laura.
That's Dave Anderson with the Forest Society, where he's Director of Education and Volunteer Services. Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Dr. Chan, Alan Eaton, Abigail Mathewson, let's go back to our listeners. And Joel joins us from Portsmouth. Hi, Joel. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
Just one simple question. If you do find one of these critters that's latched onto you, what's the best, safest, and most effective way to remove it?
It's a great question, Joel. Alan, do you want to handle that one?
The way I recommend is to use either a fine-tipped pair of forceps or one of these so-called tick spoons that has a little plastic thing that has a V-shaped notch in it. You slip the tick and its mouth parts into that notch and then carefully lever it out.
So not tweezers?
Tweezers, forceps.
Sure.
Tweezers, if they're big and flat, they're not quite as good as fine-tipped stuff. And the reason for that suggestion is that I want to hold the tick by the head. Get as close to the mouth parts as possible. If you have something big like my big old fingers or a big pair of tweezers, then they're going to be grabbing the body of the engorged tick, and they're not going to get as good a purchase on the part that we want to.
What about the nymphs, Alan? You mentioned earlier just how teeny, teeny, tiny they are. How do you even get them out if you can even recognize them as a nymph and not a freckle?
And for me, I've learned where my freckles are, and so when I see a freckle that's out of place, I pay attention.
Uh-huh.
And I do the same thing. I use the fine-tipped forceps or a tick spoon, and that works for me. And it works for all the species of ticks we have. So it's a technique that works, and that's what I recommend every time.
Dr. Chan?
Yeah, I just want to reinforce again that, you know, if somebody finds a tick and removes it, you know, before 36 hours or so have passed from when the tick bite began, there really is not much of a concern for getting Lyme disease because they would have removed the tick before the tick could have transmitted the Lyme disease. If for some reason somebody finds a tick after that time period, there is a prophylactic antibiotic, a single dose of an antibiotic that can be given to prevent Lyme disease from developing.
So if you're not quite sure if
right.
you got it or not and you don't want to wait to feel lousy,
you give your doctor a call, and there's a prescription for a single dose of an antibiotic called doxycycline that can be given to, you know, teenagers and adults to prevent Lyme disease from developing.
Interesting. Okay, let's go back to our listeners again, and John is in Nashua. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I'm calling because I've had Lyme disease for about 3.5 months, It started the end of January. I got symptoms. The problem is I can't tolerate the antibiotics needed to doxycycline, minocycline. I've even tried herbal antimicrobials, and I'm even more hypersensitive to them and quickly experience severe reactions to extremely small doses, and sometimes even on the first dose. The problem is I've been 3 months with Lyme, and there's no treatment on the horizon for me. So
did you get tested, John, by the way, so you know you have Lyme?
Yes.
Okay.
I've had three tests, including one from Igenix, the West Coast. I've also had, I've been analyzed by three different practitioners. My PCP, my doctor, didn't believe I had Lyme because the first two tests came back negative. But my symptoms are consistent. I'm getting worse. The Igenix test came back positive. And anything I take, I just... have a real problem to the point where it feels life-threatening.
Wow, John, I'm so sorry to hear about that. So, Dr. Chan, I don't know if you can help, but some people don't tolerate these medicines well. Is there anything out there for them?
Yeah, this is a difficult situation, and, you know, I can appreciate, John, thanks for calling in and sharing that. I know there's a lot of pain and suffering out there from Lyme disease. I think John brings up a couple of good points. One is about the testing and the other is about treatment. So let me first make mention of the treatment. You know, there are different options for antibiotics. You know, doxycycline is one of the first line drugs or antibiotics that we go to treat Lyme disease. But there are other options such as amoxicillin or other penicillin-based antibiotics. So, you know, I think the important thing is for people to talk to their healthcare provider. Healthcare provider should be, you know, very up to date in terms of knowing how to treat this. The question about testing, and I think, you know, what John brought up is a interesting point to make, is that there are different labs out there that do different types of testing, and not all of the testing that is done is, you know, recommended or FDA approved or recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Your healthcare provider will know what is the best test to order. Some of these private labs, I think John mentioned Igenix, you know, don't have the type of, you know, oversight and validation of their testing that some of the, like, hospital laboratories, for example, use. And so we run into this all the time where people go to their doctors, they get tested, the test is negative, they go to a private lab like Igenix, and then the test comes back positive, and it understandably creates a lot of confusion. What does this mean? People are having symptoms, and it puts patients and healthcare providers in a very difficult situation. So it's hard to comment on specific, you know, patient situations, but I think healthcare providers should be up to date on treatment and testing recommendations, and I believe patients should be going to their healthcare providers to discuss these.
Well, good luck with you, John, and I'm sorry to hear about your suffering. That's hard. Here's another email from Alan in Durham, and this is for you, I think, Abby. Alan asks, is it true that the key link in controlling ticks on your property is getting rid of mice rather than worrying about deer? It's a good question, Alan. Thanks for the email. Abby?
No, I don't think so. I think it's a more – I don't think you can just take one piece out of it. And I also think it's hard to take one piece out because you can't – unless you're living on an island, and we are not in New Hampshire right now, living on an island, although with climate change, who knows what's going to happen in the future. But you can't keep the mice out for long. So even if you were to eliminate all the mice in your yard or even in your neighborhood, they will eventually be coming back to set up another cycle. The same goes with deer. And I don't know that there have been studies looking at the complete removal of mice, but there have been studies looking at the complete removal of deer. And that's only effective, like I said, on an island. And they did notice when they did do that, when they had removed that reproductive host. So that reproductive host is essential for the adults to complete their life cycle, to take a big enough blood meal that they can successfully lay eggs that will carry on for the next generation. When they did do that removal, they noticed an increase in bites that humans and dogs and other animals were getting because you remove that host for the tick. So then,
one less place for the tick to go.
Right, one less place for the tick to go. So they saw a bubble of disease after that. When they were looking at their case rates and stuff, they saw an increase in tick bites from that. So it's vector-borne diseases like Lyme disease, anaplasma, babesia, Powassan and some of the others that we watch are very complex, and you can't always just take one piece out and think that you've solved the problem. You have to go for a multimodal approach, and we're lucky enough to have Dr. Alan Eaton in our state because he's the integrated pest management specialist, and going for that integrated approach is the way to go, I feel like, to control the disease.
Alan, do you want to jump in?
I would say that we've often forgotten how important the mice are, but the way the question was posed, I think Abby gave the correct answer. So it's sometimes that we forget that mice are very important to black-legged tick populations, mice, chipmunks, and other small mammals. And so if we can focus on them perhaps a little bit more than we have been, that might be helpful.
When you say focus on them, so what does that mean exactly?
Well, for example, there's a couple of techniques that are available now that try to control the ticks that are on the mice. One of them are the so-called tick tubes that are full of cotton treated with permethrin, the same insecticide we talked about earlier. They're designed to be spread around your property at the proper time. And if you do it in the right way, then the mice and chipmunks find it, collect it, bring it back to their nests. And then when the ticks on the mice drop off, they drop off into the pesticide-treated cotton and die. So there's one technique that's aiming at the ticks on the mice. Another one of the so-called tick boxes, which have a little bait block inside them. And they're available only through contract with a pest control company. But the idea is the mouse or chipmunk repeatedly goes in to feed on the stuff, and every time it goes in and out, brushes against a wick soaked in fipronil, the same material that is used for the top spot treatment that we talked about on dogs. So those are two examples of treatments that are designed to focus on the ticks that are on the mice. And Abby talked about bird feeders and how they spill. So there's various ways that we can encourage mice. And if we recognize those and pay a little bit more attention, I think we'll be a little more successful. I like the way she answered that.
So if you have a very ticky yard, Abby, there's some things that you can do to reduce the number of ticks. Can't get rid of them all, but some help.
There certainly are. I also, just to piggyback a little bit on the mice, it's also good to try and exclude them from your dwellings. So making sure that you have rodent-proofed your homes and garages and the like. But also being aware of what your landscaping looks like. You know, New Hampshire has some just fantastic, beautiful stone walls, but those are perfect rodent habitat. And they're also pretty wet, humid places, so good for tick survivorship in those kinds of areas. And it's hard to maintain some of the shorter grass around that, but if you can have areas in your yard that are what we would consider tick safe zones, so the open short grass that is sunny, that'll serve to not provide much habitat for the ticks. It's very drying for the black-legged ticks, so you won't have much tick survivorship there. The rodents and the deer will not necessarily like to be out in the middle of something like that. They'll want to kind of be along the edges looking for where their normal food sources would be. Being mindful of the plants you have in your yard. So, you know, deer really like fruit trees, like crabapple trees and things like that. And you can get deer browse resistant plants. You can go to your garden centers and talk to them about that. But being mindful about pulling your bird feeders when the snow's off the ground, being aware of what other kinds of grasses and habitats that you've created in your environment.
And mow the lawn, right?
And mow the lawn. If you have play equipment in your yard, make sure it's away from the edge habitat. You can set up a 3-foot buffer around your yard with mulch or pea gravel or something like that. Or you can also put your play equipment on mulch. The ticks don't like to go horizontal. They like to crawl up. And so that's something to keep in mind. So if you don't give them vertical surfaces to climb in your yard, they'll not prefer to be there.
One more question about sort of backyard management of ticks. Alan, I'll throw this to you. You know, with mosquitoes, towns often perform spraying of areas where mosquitoes breed and so forth. Can you do that for ticks, or are they too widespread?
I think that to be successful, it has to be done on a particular piece of property rather than a widespread situation, because, of course, these things don't have wings as adult mosquitoes do. Mosquitoes have the ability to spread from the areas where they the water where they lived as immatures, whereas ticks are much slower. Their main method of being spread around is by hitchhiking on people while they're biting them or
other
animals. So
they're
not really,
they're not congregating in ponds and places
That's
like
right.
that. They're kind of everywhere.
So you on a piece-by-piece situation, treatment of that one particular property. And in some cases, towns or school districts are focusing on that. In others, there's debate and they hand out repellent instead.
Okay. Well, and Dr. Chan, we just have about a minute left, and I did want to give you the chance to just put out your final thoughts or your final message for folks as we enter the wonderful summer season here in New Hampshire.
Absolutely. And I think the first message is that people should try and prevent the tick bite at all costs, you know, through the variety of mechanisms. That's the easiest thing to do. And then you don't have to worry about if you do get bitten, what do you do? Do you need antibiotics? If somebody does find a tick on themselves and it's been there for longer than 36 hours, there is a prophylactic antibiotic that can prevent developing Lyme disease. If somebody thinks they have developed Lyme disease or develops that, you know, characteristic bullseye rash, they should talk to their healthcare provider. Long-term antibiotics generally are not recommended. This bacteria tends to be very susceptible to the types of antibiotics that are out there. But people should talk about their health concerns with their providers.
And the prophylactic, the sort of quick hit antibiotic you mentioned, Dr. Chan, is that also effective against some of the other tick-borne illnesses that you mentioned?
So I'm not aware of studies that have shown it to be effective for prevention. But in terms of this, some of these antibiotics like doxycycline can also be used to treat other tick infections like anaplasma. So, you know, a lot of times people will have not just one but two different types of infections, you know, Lyme disease and anaplasma. And, you know, a short course of antibiotics, a couple of weeks, will treat both infections in their early stages.
All of you, thank you very much for being here. Great information. And again, we've put a ton on our website. So go to nhpr.org/exchange for more information. This is The Exchange on NHPR.